positive for COVID-19, which has as one of its symptoms the creation of hallucinations, you would be right to be concerned about the deployment of the nuclear football, the briefcase with nuclear launch codes that follows the president everywhere so that he can launch nuclear Armageddon anywhere, at any time, with no check or balance. But then you talk with someone who knows as much about the launch codes as any civilian can, and he tells you,
there has been some reporting, unconfirmed, and certainly not anything that the government has spoken about publicly, that in recent weeks and months, the military aides with the president have been given basically a COVID checklist, that there are steps that they are supposed to take before validating and passing along a launch order from the president. Again, we don't know whether that's actually true, but that has been reported.
Well, that's new, and it's not anything you've heard from Dan Rather or the New York Times. Still, fasten your seatbelt, because no matter where in the world you are, we're all in a state of heightened awareness about that awful, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a special breaking story on what the president's COVID diagnosis and medical treatment means in relation to the nuclear football. The nuclear launch codes that follow him around at all times, because you never know when it's time to start Armageddon. We'll talk with distinguished journalist Garrett Graff, author of many books, among them Raven Rock, the story of the U.S. government's secret plan to save itself while the rest of us die. Garrett knows more about the nuclear football than any guest we've had on in 9.5 years of Nuclear Hot Seat. So he has a lot to say that you aren't hearing anywhere else. And then we talk with Makoma Lekalakala, a South African social, economic, environmental activist whose work took down her government's $76 billion deal with the Russians for between 8 and 10 nuclear reactors, for which she and her associate won the 2018 Goldman Environmental Prize for Africa. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than will find its way into tomorrow night's U.S. vice presidential debate, all of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, October 6, 2020, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Okay, let's cut to the chase. The world has been transfixed by U.S. President Donald Trump's COVID-19 diagnosis, his hospitalization at Walter Reed, and his subsequent actions. But the big question for those of us who focus on nuclear issues is the nuclear football. The launch codes for nuclear weapons to which the president has sole and unimpeded power to use. How might a disease that has as one of its symptoms the creation of hallucinations and the steroid with which Trump is being treated, dexamethasone, which has side effects that can include aggression, anxiety, irritability, mood changes, trouble thinking, and grandiose delusions, how might that impact world safety? While the president's medical state is being sliced and diced by mainstream media, I decided it was important to explore the situation with the launch codes. And for that, I contacted Garrett Graff. He is an esteemed magazine journalist, best-selling historian, a regular TV commentator who has spent more than a dozen years covering politics, technology, and national security, and author of the book Raven Rock, the story of the U.S. government's secret plan to save itself while the rest of us die. In that book, Garrett not only wrote about the nuclear launch codes, he reports that he has seen them. He likens them not to a big red button, but to a Denny's menu. I previously interviewed Garrett Graff for Nuclear Hot Seat number 366 from June 26, 2018. He graciously made himself available this morning, October 6, 2020, to talk about this very important and thus far overlooked issue.
Garrett Graff, thanks so much for making the time this morning to speak to us for Nuclear Hot Seat.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me again.
There is, of course, concern because President Trump has been diagnosed with COVID-19, and there are a number of circumstances that bring into question what is happening with the nuclear football during this time. So if you could start out, explain to the listeners briefly what the nuclear football is.
The nuclear football is actually technically known as the President's Emergency Satchel. And it is the 35-pound briefcase that accompanies the president wherever he is, anywhere in the world, with all of the instructions and options for launching a nuclear strike from wherever he is. It is carried by a rotating set of five military aides assigned to the president, and 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, it is never very far from the president. You know, if he gets on a elevator, the nuclear football gets on the elevator with him. If he is on the golf course, the nuclear football and the military aide is in the third golf cart behind the president himself. So this is something that he has access to wherever and he is at any time of day.
When Donald Trump was diagnosed with COVID-19 and he went into Walter Reed Hospital in the presidential suite, was the football carried by someone into the suite with him? Was that person actually in a COVID-contaminated area?
So we don't actually know precisely the movements of the football while inside Walter Reed, but it was definitely with him and would have been close by if it was not in the room, in the presidential suite itself. Regardless, it would have been easily accessible to him within a minute or two of needing it.
How about during that 15-minute drive around that he took? Was perhaps one of the Secret Service members in the car carrying it?
Yeah, so normally the football is either in the same mode of transportation that the president is in, or it is in one of the other vehicles that is part of what is known as the secure package, which is the handful of armored limousines or SUVs that carry the president and his closest aides.
We know that COVID-19 by itself can manifest as hallucinations, and that the side effect of the steroid dexamethasone with which the president is being treated carries with it a range of potential side effects, including mental problems such as aggression, agitation, and anxiety. Does this in any way lead you to have thoughts about the appropriateness of having Donald Trump still in possession of the nuclear launch codes?
So one of the interesting things is there has been some reporting, unconfirmed, and certainly not anything that the government has spoken about publicly, that in recent weeks and months, the military aides with the president have been given basically a COVID checklist, that there are steps that they are supposed to take before validating and passing along a launch order from the president. And again, we don't know whether that's actually true, but that has been reported, and we don't know exactly what the procedures would entail if that was true, but it would be consistent, actually, with some past practice. We know that during some of the darkest hours of Richard Nixon's presidency, for instance, James Schlesinger, the defense secretary, Henry Kissinger, the National Security Advisor and Secretary of State, left word with the military aides effectively that any launch orders from the president should be double-checked with them. Those are not normal procedures. You know, part of what many Americans are realizing for the first time in the era of Donald Trump is that under normal circumstances, nuclear launch authority is the sole purview of the president, that he does not actually need a second voice or a second okay of his order, that basically he can launch whenever he wants for whatever reason. And that is a scenario that lawmakers in Congress are beginning to revisit and sort of wondering if there are different procedures that we should put into place to protect the country going forward.
What are your thoughts about this? How difficult a situation is the country in right now, and what might be the potential?
The short answer is what we are facing right now is a situation that has been widely contemplated by emergency planners over the years, and at this moment, at least, not a particularly complicated one for emergency planners. There are very good procedures in place for a president to be ill or incapacitated under normal circumstances. We keep sort of a spare apparatus for the president around the vice president. The vice president has his own nuclear football with him at all times, and he could rapidly assume presidential authority or have presidential authority transferred to him voluntarily by the president to become acting president in the event of a medical procedure or illness. So until the vice president himself is also ill or incapacitated, this is a relatively straightforward question under normal circumstances. You know, part of the challenge is the unique mentality and personality of Donald Trump himself. You know, when previous presidents have activated that acting president protocol, as George W. Bush and Ronald Reagan did during their own medical procedures, you know, they were self-confident and self-assured enough that they were okay to give up the authority of the presidency temporarily. This, by contrast, is a president who is, by all accounts, deeply insecure and much less likely to give up the presidential authority if it seems necessary. And I think that does pose a unique danger and challenge for the country as we navigate the days and weeks ahead.
If there was a scenario where Donald Trump did not relinquish control of the football, and through either an hallucination that came because of COVID or some reaction to one of the medications he's on, suddenly decided to launch, is there a check and a balance that could stop that from happening?
The short answer is no and maybe. Under the technical procedures for nuclear launches, no, there is no check on presidential authority. That is caveated, though, that the military does not need to follow illegal orders that violate the rules of war. When Americans hear that, they sort of, I think, though, misunderstand what that necessarily means, that they think that means that the military could turn down any launch order that it wanted, that it thought was unjust. But really, it sort of more means it would be difficult to okay an order that seemed unprovoked or out of proportion with the threat. So that becomes a very, a much more sort of situational guide for the military about how exactly it would respond to a launch order. Again, though, there is this reporting in recent weeks and months that the military aides with the president have been asked to go through sort of a COVID specific checklist to demonstrate and reassure themselves that the president is functioning normally prior to passing along a launch order. Again, we don't know whether that's true. We don't know what that COVID checklist could look like, but there's at least the possibility in this instance that a check like that does exist in the system.
Anything you'd like to add at this time?
No, you've covered a lot.
I've been thinking about this a lot. Okay, so Garrett Graff, you are the most knowledgeable person I have encountered when it comes to the nuclear launch code, and I really appreciate you taking the time this morning on such short notice to speak with the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat.
Oh, my pleasure.
Garrett Graff. He is author of many books, among them Raven Rock, the story of the U.S. government's secret plan to save itself while the rest of us die. That's the one that contains a lot of information about the nuclear football. You can hear more about that amazing book in our interview from Nuclear Hot Seat number 366 from July 26, 2018. And yes, of course, we will link to it on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 485. Breaking, a late-breaking edition. Just prior to posting this show on Wednesday, October 7, we received a Bloomberg report that two of President Trump's military aides have tested positive for COVID-19. These aides act as what Bloomberg called valets, who always travel with the president carrying the nuclear launch codes in a briefcase known as the nuclear football. From the Nuclear Hot Seat interview with Garrett Graff, we know that there are a total of five such military personnel tasked with carrying the launch codes, meaning that as of now, there are only three. And that's what we know thus far. We will update this story next week. In other news, in the U.S., Texas Governor Greg Abbott, a Republican, has come out against two rival plans to ship highly radioactive waste from the nation's nuclear power plants to sites on the Texas-New Mexico border, saying either plan would be unsafe and would threaten the region's sprawling Permian Basin oil field. That's what he wrote in a letter to President Donald Trump, to which Karen Haddon, an environmental advocate who leads the Austin-based Sustainable Energy and Economic Development Coalition, or SEED Coalition, said, "It's an unusual thing for environmentalists and oil companies to be on the same page, and we are on this issue." Democratic New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham also wrote to the president over the summer expressing much the same sentiments. In Utah, the first U.S. small-scale nuclear power project, which has been grappling with cost overruns and delays, faces another challenge, the defection of cities that had committed to buying its power. Of the more than 30 members of the Public Power Consortium Utah Associated Municipal Power Systems, or UAMPS, two cities, Logan and Lehi, Utah, have already walked away from the project, and according to the Power Department Director for Bountiful Utah, chances are 50-50 that it will withdraw. But other nuke news out of Utah isn't quite as good.
Nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, nuclear hot seat, none that's out of week.
Utah Corporation Energy Fuels is importing 136 tons of radioactive material from Japan, and the public is not allowed to comment on this because Energy Fuels is calling the material from the Japan Atomic Energy Agency ore, not waste. And the Utah Department of Environmental Quality's Uranium Mills Radioactive Materials Program agreed. Because the White Mesa Mill already has a permit to process ore, put that in quotes, it wasn't required to submit a plan for the 136 tons of Japanese uranium-loaded sands, resins, and carbon left over from experimental nuclear extraction techniques, as well as natural uranium-bearing ores. Once again, semantics in service to nuclear industry malfeasance and public danger. And that is why, this week, Utah Department of Environmental Quality's Uranium Mills Radioactive Materials Program and Energy Fuel Resources USA, Inc., you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of week.
Two articles I'm going to link to. In the first, in the unhappy event that the world's nuclear powers cut loose with their atomic weapons, Nebraska is one of a handful of states in the West and Midwest whose role in Armageddon is to soak up an unfathomable first strike of Russian bombs.
Nebraska, Montana, North Dakota, Wyoming, Colorado, and western Nebraska are meant to be sitting ducks for any first strike by the Russians because they contain 450 Minuteman III missile silos containing 400 nuclear-tipped intercontinental ballistic missiles. And a second link will be to the article, Why American Nuclear Weapons in Europe No Longer Make Sense and Should Be Brought Home. Over to Japan, where a new study shows that tiny fragments of plutonium may have been carried more than 200 kilometers, that's 125 miles, by cesium particles released after the meltdown at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant in Japan in 2011. Make that triple meltdown, three nuclear reactors in meltdown. A new study by an international group of scientists reveals that while plutonium from the accident had been detected as far as 50 kilometers, 31 miles from the damaged reactors, some of it may have escaped from the stricken facility in particulate form that hitched a ride on fragments of cesium-rich microparticles. And we'll link to an article from The Nation on how a news report on Hiroshima helped prevent nuclear war. And this is a reference to the 1946 article by John Hersey called Hiroshima, later published as a book and turned into a movie. In Ukraine, hackers were able to successfully crack the encryption of the Rivne nuclear power plant's servers and then spread fake information about a disaster there, which included radiation release, fire safety, and environmental background that had not changed and remained within normal limits. In North Korea, a reservoir dam near the country's Yongbyon nuclear complex has been breached, resulting in reduced water level that has left the two pump houses servicing the reactor's cooling systems high and dry. The inability to maintain a stable reservoir level poses a potential problem for continuous reactor operations and cooling. The reactor was once the source of weapons-grade plutonium for North Korea, and the country can still harvest one nuclear bomb worth of plutonium by reprocessing spent fuel from the reactor. Reuters reports that the number of nuclear reactor units operating globally is at a 30-year low, with new plants struggling for investment. And we will link to esteemed journalist Carl Grossman's article, Nuclear Power, a Gargantuan Threat. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, there are so many issues begging for our attention and involvement these days. COVID-19, the U.S. presidential election, climate change disasters, including wildfires, ice melt in the Arctic, and extreme weather events, international warmongering, and I'm sure you've got your own personal list of issues that are making demands for your attention, pulling at your heart and soul, and yes, I understand, it is hard to know where to put your attention. And nuclear is rarely at the top of that list. But as you just heard from this week's lead story, nuclear deserves to be at the head of the list because all our lives right now are dependent upon the president's nuclear football not being used. And the information we uncovered is at this moment unique to Nuclear Hot Seat. Not even the New York Times or Dan Rather have it yet, but I'm willing to bet they will. But this is why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. We know where to look for the nuclear story, know the questions to ask that mainstream reporters don't, and report the ongoing evolving nuclear truth that the radioactive industry would rather we not hear about, let alone understand. That is why the time would be right now, to support us with a donation. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button. That's where you can help us with a donation of any size. And that same red button is now where you can set up a monthly $5. Now look, it's the same as a cup of coffee and a nice tip here in the U.S. when places are open again. So please do what you can now. Don't wait. Just hit pause for a moment and take care of it now while you're thinking about it. And know that however much you can help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here is this week's featured interview. Successes against nuclear must be celebrated, along with those who make them happen. And my next guest has had immeasurable impact, preventing nuclear disaster on her people and to her country. Makoma Lakalakala is a self-described South African social, economic, environmental activist with decades of organizing experience. Working with activist partner Liz McDade, in 2017, their investigation, organizing efforts, and a subsequent lawsuit had them facing down Vladimir Putin and their country's recently deposed leader, Jacob Zuma. Ultimately, they overturned the South African government's $76 billion deal for between 8 and 10 Russian nuclear reactors. For this work, she and Liz won the prestigious 2018 Goldman Environmental Prize for Africa. We spoke on Friday, September 11, 2020. Makoma Lekalakala, thank you so much for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, and thank you to you for hosting me.
You refer to yourself as a social, economic, environmental activist. What do you mean by putting together all of those descriptors?
Before I became an environmentalist, I was a social justice activist. And because there's direct connections, if you're protecting the social rights of people, economic rights of people, the environment comes in. You can't do anything in an unhealthy environment. And that's why I call them myself all those, just also to make connections to other people that these are interlinked, there's no difference at all. So if you wage a struggle for environmental rights or environmental justice, it links directly to your economic rights, it links directly to your social justice rights.
How did you first become involved in activism?
I grew up in Soweto. And at the time, when I grew up as a student, I grew up at a time when the uprisings were high. As a teenager around the 70s, and when I became a young adult in the 80s, it was at the height of the apartheid struggle, when we were protesting against the injustices that were taking place around us. And also because in the area where I lived in, that was an area where there were a lot of student leaders stayed around the area. I had to work at an early age, unfortunately, at around 18 or so. And that's when I became involved in the trade union movement. And I must say that the labor movement groomed me. It opened my eyes. It made me to realize a whole lot of things that are happening around us.
How did the activism that you learned through union work lead to your joining EarthLife Africa?
Before I joined EarthLife Africa, I was involved in other struggles, more particularly in social justice struggles. I was also very active in the Jubilee movement for the cancellation of the debt. And that's then after I had joined EarthLife through an invitation by a former colleague. And that's how the interest and the passion sparked. And I've been with EarthLife for almost about 10 years now.
What was South Africa's nuclear situation in the past before you became involved with it?
One is that we have one nuclear power station in the whole of Africa, which is Kubek Power Station. And incidentally, when this power station was commissioned, that's when EarthLife Africa was born. That is around 32 years ago. And we also have a nuclear medicine in the country where there's manufacturing of nuclear medicine. As you know, that South Africa is one of the leading ones. But then when the nuclear power station was built, by then it was at the height of apartheid. So people were not involved in the decision making whether they would want to have a nuclear as part of the energy mix or not. So this was something that was really imposed on the people. And we understood by then that the apartheid government, it was another way of them hiding that the possibility of manufacturing nuclear arms.
What was the secret deal that South Africa was trying to create with Russia, and how did you find out about it?
The nuclear situation in the country, the South African government has been trying for some time to build more nuclear reactors, and they have had some agreement with the different countries like the US, like Korea, and those nuclear agreements were on the table. But when it came to the Russian one, we found the former president frequenting Russia and having meetings there. So one of our partner organizations, Eco Defense, found out that I think that was publicized in the Russian media. And besides, because the organization is a watchdog of Rosatom, they found out that there's actually an intergovernmental agreement with South Africa that is very detailed. And that being detailed, the worrying aspect of that was that the Rosatom Russia would be able to construct nuclear reactors in South Africa, and should anything happen or should anything go wrong, so Rosatom is not involved or Russia is not involved, it will be upon the South African government and the South African people to see to themselves as to get out of the situation. So this was very risky. Besides that being very risky, for us as South Africans and as Africans, we have abundant renewable energy. We have got solar, we've got wind that could be used for electricity generation. And besides that, that is a quick way of ensuring that people have got access to electricity. And with the nuclear reactors, we know that with any mega project, we have Medupi here already that is almost more than, I think it's going up to its eighth or sixth year not being complete. And the cost overruns over that. This some of the stuff that worried us, because anything nuclear, it's secretive. And every time the South African Constitution allows us to request information, but with the nuclear industry, we know that everything has got to be secretive, and we were going to also struggle to get any sort of information from the South African government. But we also learned at the same time that Rosatom, it's one of those corporations that are very, besides being very secretive, they are also very corrupt. So it was a whole lot of human rights violations and also a destruction of the environment that was coming before us if we didn't stop that.
When you found out about this deal, what was the initial response by EarthLife Africa and by yourself?
One thing is that when we found out, when our partner EcoDefense, Vladimir Silviak, contacted us, the first thing that we did, we wanted concrete evidence of what the organization was sharing with us. And they sent us a link from the website, and the link was in Russian, so we had to quickly find somebody to translate that to us and also print it out, so that at least we've got documentation. And I think we did the right thing, because after a few days or the following day after we raised questions with the Department of Energy, that website post was taken off Rosatom's website. And then it told us that something fishy is going on here. And when we asked from the department, they said that this is just the normal agreements that countries do have continuously, so there's nothing to worry about. But because of, as activists, as human rights defenders, as people who are anti-corruption, we were smelling a rat that something is really going on here, particularly based on the involvement of Rosatom with its secretive and corrupt activities, also including the former president of the country, who had, there were a lot of allegations around corruption on him.
How did you and your Goldman Prize coal winner, Liz McDade, first learn about each other and decide to team up on this issue?
I think myself and Liz come from very far. If you realize, we're more or less the same age. So we both were activists during the apartheid era. And we met through the work on energy, particularly around education and sharing information, and also making sure that women become part of the energy democracy decisions in the country. And that's a relationship that spans like more than kind of 15 years or so. And we're still working together. It's still very strong. And today we had a joint presentation. But one thing that I think was there was our commitment, because as activists during the apartheid era, we wouldn't allow anything that we struggled for, that our fellow comrades died for, to continue. If our fellow comrades died to protect the hard-won gains or our fellow comrades died because they wanted us to have the gains that we had during right now. So we wouldn't allow their death to be in vain, in a sense that whatever they fought for, it's still happening, and we just let it go like that. So our conscience was very strong. And our conscience being strong, coming from that background, we also made sure that we team together in our organizations, bring in more people to work with us to challenge these corrupt nuclear deals. And what was interesting was that in all the alliances, networks, and the work that we did, one was that more women came in. And for us, it was a realization that women have been left out of the decision-making processes around energy, and that they are the ones who know the impact of high tariffs. They are the ones who know the impact of externalized costs that are related to any mega infrastructure project, particularly with the nuclear reactors going to be built in pristine areas in the country.
When you first learned about this secret deal between South Africa and Russia, what was the situation when you started, and how did you begin strategizing your work from that point forward?
I must say that this was not an individual kind of action. It was organizational actions. It was also networks and coalitions that were involved. So in the organization, we went through the documentation that we had. We had strategy sessions. We also reached out to organizations and shared with them this kind of information, but with backed up by evidence of the letters that we have sent to the ministers, the letters that we have been corresponding with the department, just to show them that there's something really very fishy here, because in most of the time, some of our concerns were not responded to. And because it was organizational decisions. And when we came to decide that because of no responses, because of like we not taken seriously, the best things for us to go to court. So my offering and Liz's offering that we are going to launch or to file this case, I think that's the biggest step that we took together, because there were many, a lot of people that were involved. But with us, it was more of the filing of the court case to say we're taking the government to court over this. And I must say, when we made a press release, we let the nation know and our partners know that we're taking the government to court. Some of the responses we got from particularly our detractors, they were saying, you guys are crazy. Do you think you can take the president of the country to court? You must just let this thing happen. I mean, there's nothing wrong. People, we've got high tariffs already, but we had to go and we had to explain to people. So it took us more time for us to be able to explain to people, why are we taking the president to court? Why is it wrong for the decisions to be taken behind the scenes, and that we also smell corruption? The other things that we had facts on the table, in that there were other intergovernmental agreements that were signed that were put up front with the Russian one. And when you check the Russian one, it's recent and more details. And the other ones, they are old. Like, how do you take a 15-year or 20-year-old intergovernmental agreement with a one-month intergovernmental agreement? Obviously, there's going to be a vast difference, because the detailed one would also speak to the context, would also add more of the stuff that is not on the one that was 20 years ago. So these were some of the stuff that we had to explain to people, but also standing firm and making sure that we take this forward. It was not easy for us, for both of us. As you know, that when you raise anything illegal with the government, that the government is doing, it becomes illegal for you to do that. So it was not a very good situation, but because we were convinced, we knew what we were doing and that what the government was doing was wrong, we stood firm, and standing firm in the courts vindicated us.
To be clear, was it you and Liz doing this, or you were the front people for your organizations?
I would say we were the front people for our organizations.
What did it take for you to keep going with this against whatever obstacles were placed in front of you?
your conviction, which is what we were convinced. We knew the facts. We know what we were doing. And secondly, in that, for any change to happen, someone has to instigate that change. Someone has got to step forward. And we sacrificed ourselves to step forward, and because we knew that what we were doing, it's for the protection of the hard-won gains that our people sacrificed their lives for. And also that we would like to see a world where justice reigns, where there is no injustice. And there is a passion for life, a passion for the future, and also ensuring that the future generations don't find themselves in a situation bad enough for them to survive. So those were the things that were driving us, protecting our land, protecting our environments, and making sure that we don't leave a legacy of radioactive waste from many reactors that were proposed to be built.
What was the timeline that it took for you to move your case forward until it got to the High Court?
Funny enough, it took about 2 years. The case was filed in the Western Cape High Court. And I must say that we're not expecting that kind of speedy proceedings. I think for myself, I had said this may take about 10 years or so, because obviously this was the first case around procurement. And but though we were sure, but we were shocked that the case took such a speedy turnover. We launched the case on the 15th of October 2015, and the case was resolved on the 26th of April 2017. So it was more or less 2 years. And in that 2 years, we had endured a lot of delays from the government saying they're still looking for documents. And we saw those who were pro-nuclear trying to come in and trying to derail the whole case. But then that turnover of 2 years also convinced us that active citizenry does work, and also we can trust the South African courts.
As a result of this success, what was the response in South Africa?
I think one thing is that as we speak now, the people in South Africa were very happy. One, in the sense that at least there are people who can stand up to the bullying of the government and the bullying and the abuse of power by those that are in government. But the second thing is that the case also was a contributor, I think so, was a contributor towards the downfall of President Zuma. Besides the nuclear deal case, there were also other allegations of misgovernment from him. And so this case, the way the other partners, because we're not working alone as the two organizations and two individuals, the way it was linked, the nuclear deals were linked to a whole lot of issues and allegations that were raised. It became clear that this also contributed towards a turning point to the politics of South Africa. But however, one thing I would say that this case saved the economy, because now we'd be indebted for over $1 trillion or more than that to Rosatom. And secondly, our people would not enjoy the basic services that are due to them, because money for cost recovery to Rosatom would be from the secret agreements. We don't know how that was done, but we feel that this was a waste of money, because South Africa doesn't have that money. And also South Africa was going to be left with centuries of radioactive waste. But the other thing that the case did, I think it also created some sort of a domino effect, that other people, other organizations were now taking the government to court for various other, not that that didn't happen, it did happen before, but after we saw a surge of individuals and organizations also taking the government to court on various other issues.
You and Liz McDade won the Goldman Environmental Prize in 2018. What did winning it mean to you? And what difference, if any, has it made for you and your work?
One is that it came as a surprise and also as a shock, because this is something that I didn't know that it could ever happen. But one is that I must say that both myself and Liz, we welcomed the recognition. And this also assisted us in our work in so many other ways. The award also elevated our work, so more people globally were able to know our work. So we were inundated with requests to share our story, to share our strategies. And this was one moment that I think, and that the work that we did had also inspired other people in other countries and also in South Africa. But what also was important was that it also assisted in boosting confidence in a lot of women that had concerns, and some of them were saying we can't do because here are two ordinary South African women who are friends, who have been activists, and who are being recognized for this work. But for me, it meant a lot more that the generations of my mothers, my mothers, that I would say my great grandmothers and my mothers, the resilience that I had, the fighting that I have, the bravery that I have, that means I still carry that with me. And it's for me to pass it on to other people, to make them realize that it is possible, we can do everything, though we're doing at a local level. There are people outside there who are looking at what you're doing, and that resilience and that courage of taking up issues and fighting for rights, so everyone can do it. And that's what made me comfortable in accepting the prize, that it's a recognition, not only for me, but also for the past, present, and also for the future generations that are going to be fighting injustice.
Where are you focusing your work now?
My work is around mitigation on climate change, focusing on nuclear energy, challenging nuclear. Already the current Minister of Energy has been trying to revive the nuclear project of the government. And we had, again, to stand up with Liz and our partners and to challenge them, to remind them of the court case ruling, to also remind them of the commitments that they have made, that there would be no nuclear energy program without satisfying the legislation and regulation in the country. So that's something that we've done, like, in the past 2-3 months ago, standing up against the new Minister of Energy and mitigation against climate change. I'm also working around coal, pushing back coal. Coal has got externalized impacts on local communities, whether it's coal mining, whether it's coal-fired power stations. And besides the nuclear court case, my organization, which I also was leading on the case, we had filed a case against the South African government on the climate change impacts, because the government was authorizing a coal-fired power station, and them authorizing that coal-fired power station, it was at a backdrop of them having made commitment internationally that they are committing to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And then how do you authorize a coal-fired power station? We took the government to court, and on the 8th of March 2017, that actually was before the ruling of the nuclear court case, then we won that case against the government. So that was the first ever South African climate change case. On top of that, besides coal, being anti-coal and also challenging nuclear, we work with community-based organizations. We share information. We're activating people to be active citizens, not to just sit down and just let everything happen, just to be part of whatever process happens and demand to be part of decision-making processes, to demand free prior informed consent on any project that is being proposed in their areas. This is the kind of work that the organization, including myself, we're involved in that we want to build an active citizenry, but also build, strengthen a movement for environmental justice in the country.
What, if anything, has been your involvement with the United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons and the movement to have it ratified by South Africa?
I must confess that that has not been an area of focus, though there are people that have looked deeply into that. But then with our partners, as we challenging a nuclear, but I have not really taken part actively in that. But then the South African government, after the unbanning of the organizations and around 1994, had taken a resolution. The African National Congress, which is the ruling party, had taken a resolution which was tabled, and the government had said that they're not going to be involved in any nuclear weapons or nuclear arms at all. And I'm glad that the African Union also has taken that position, though I'm aware that a whole lot of people in Africa are not aware of that, because we still see uranium mining taking place. We still see other African governments signing intergovernmental agreement or agreements of cooperation, particularly with Russia and China. So it means that the issues are not interlinked, and it is our challenge as anti-nuclear campaigners to link up the issues and ensure that no more uranium mining in the African continent, and the African governments just walk their talk. If they had signed the protocols from the African Union, and some of them have ratified the United Nations Arms Treaty, they have to walk their talk and ensure that there's no nuclear activities that should take place in different countries, including South Africa.
You have experienced great success with your work. For all of us around the world who struggle against nuclear issues, everything from uranium mining and the lack of cleanup and its environmental genocide to reactors, waste, and weapons, what can you share with us that will help keep us focused and on the path and moving forward?
One is that we all have to be alive that nuclear is not a transitional energy. Right now, people, based on the reports from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change from the UNFCCC, we're talking about a just transition. And the IPCC had said that we currently, the temperatures are rising more, our diversity is being degraded, and we have to act to ensure that this does not happen. So if this does not have to happen, it's up to us as people to act. Today, I had something from one of the webinars that I attended, that if you see that it's wrong, don't just leave it like that. Act and do something. But for us, I think if we talk about a just recovery, we talk about a just transition. Nuclear cannot be a transitional technology towards a low carbon development. And it's up to us to ensure, to challenge that nuclear cannot be a solution to climate change. And we know what the nuclear arms have produced, but we have to strive for peace, because if there's no peace, there is no justice. And it's for us to think not only about us, but about the future generation, so that they can live a better life than we are today.
Makoma Lekalakala, thank you for the work that you have done. Thank you for your leadership, and for being such a stunning example of how effective a woman and other women can be in the fight against climate change and the nuclear issue. And I want to thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you. Don't nuke the climate.
Makoma Lekalakala is a South African social, economic, environmental activist whose investigation, organizing efforts, and subsequent lawsuit overturned her government's $76 billion deal to purchase between 8 and 10 Russian nuclear reactors. For this work, she and her partner, Liz McDade, won the prestigious 2018 Goldman Environmental Prize for Africa.
Activists, shout out.
Condolences to all of us on the passing of Sister Ardith Platt of the Dominican Order of Preachers and also the Plowshares Movement. In a beautiful life well lived, she stood as a justice preacher, peace seeker, teacher, compassionate neighbor, and friend who always stood with people on the margins. In the 1980s, she worked with a coalition to place an initiative on the Michigan state ballot to disallow nuclear weapons from being deployed in Michigan in preservation of freshwater lakes and soil. It passed by 56% of the vote. However, the federal government superseded the state law and brought hundreds of nuclear cruise missiles and squadrons of B-52s onto two strategic Air Force bases. Sister Ardith then began full-time organizing to witness at these bases, and within 12 years, both were closed after hundreds of people, including Sister Ardith, were arrested for civil resistance. Her activism for peace led her to represent the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons. She took part in many Plowshares actions, became part of the Dorothy Day Catholic Worker Community in Washington, D.C. in 2018, and continued to raise awareness about the use of nuclear weapons and the humanitarian and environmental impact such weapons have on the world and its citizens. Rest in power, Sister Ardith. Go have tea with Ruth. She's with Molly and Anne, and I know they would welcome you with open arms. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, October 6, 2020. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, Beyond Nuclear International, the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, or ICANN, oilprice.com, Der Spiegel, the BBC, cordis.europa.en, courthousenews.com, star-telegram.com, environnews.tv, Carl Grossman, reuters.com, smh.com.au, omaha.com, physicsworld.com, thenation.com, 1112.international.com, en.yna.co.kr, independentaustralia.net, grdominicans.org, Friends of the Earth, and the ever-co-opted Nuclear Regulatory Commission. To get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered to your inbox every week in a single email, just go to the website, nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down to the yellow opt-in box, put in your first name, put in an email address. We won't bug you, but you will be the first to get the show each week when it posts. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to me at info@nuclearhotseat.com. And if you appreciate nuclear news that is vetted, footnoted, checked thoroughly, and delivered with more than a little attitude, please consider helping us continue by going to nuclearhotseat.com. You'll see the big red button. Click on it. Follow the prompts. Do what you can. Anything will help, and we really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2020. Libby, Halevi, and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevi of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you the American launch codes for nuclear Armageddon are under the sole authority of the United States President, who currently has a disease which creates hallucinations, and who is being treated with steroids, which create side effects of mental instability and delusions of grandeur. If that is not a nuclear wake-up call, I don't know what is. Now, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.